Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast, sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Today is our second episode about German immigrants in Chicago. In the first episode, we covered the period from the 1830s through the Civil War, and now we'll cover the period from the end of the Civil War to the start of World War I, so roughly the period from 1870 to 1914, give or take some years. And with me again to help us tell the story of German immigration to Chicago is Dr. Sebastian Wupper. Welcome back, Sebastian.
Thanks for having me once again.
Sebastian Wupper received his PhD in history and MA in public history from Loyola University in Chicago. A native of Berlin, Germany, he wrote his dissertation on the 19th century German-American milieu in Chicago. He is currently engaged as a postdoctoral scholar with Loyola University Chicago, researching and documenting the entanglement of the university in the sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. He also works as an expert consultant and writer for a high school level history textbook project. So, before we get started with episode 2 here on German immigration, let's recap the first episode. The first thing we learned was that the phrase German immigrant itself is highly problematic. Germany did not exist when the first wave of German-speaking immigrants, the so-called Dreisiger, arrived in Chicago in the 1830s. So when we speak of German immigrants in the 1800s, we're actually referring to Europeans who are culturally German. But they could have been from any number of European kingdoms, principalities, provinces, or free cities where German was spoken. We also learned that Chicago was the fastest growing city on the planet in the decades between the 1830s and the 1870s. In those 50 years, Chicago grew from a mere 200 inhabitants to over 500,000 people. And by 1870, one out of three Chicagoans was actually born in a German-speaking part of Europe. Next, we learned about the second wave of Germanic immigrants, the 48ers, who were basically political refugees, many of whom were. They wanted to overthrow aristocratic systems in the various German kingdoms, and they wanted to unite all of the territory into some sort of unified German nation state that was not aristocratic. Many of them got in trouble for their activism and fled to the US, and they brought their political beliefs with them, namely their support of democracy and opposition to slavery and other forms of bondage. We also learned that there was a robust Germanic culture in Chicago throughout this period. That included German language newspapers as well as German community associations. The newspapers were extremely advanced and reported on both American and European affairs quite closely. And the community associations were very important for maintaining Germanic culture as well. There were singing clubs, as well as the so-called Turnvereine, which were basically men's fitness and social clubs. And these were also important centers for political education and political activism. Next, we learned that the Germanic people of Chicago were strong supporters of Abraham Lincoln and strong opponents of slavery. During the Civil War, Chicago Germans formed ethnic regiments to fight on the side of the Union. And we ended episode 1 with a moving image of Abraham Lincoln lying in state in Chicago after his assassination. Standing around him is a group of German-American singers from a singing club paying a tribute in song to the great president. At this point in the story, Germanic culture in Chicago is still strong. However, the next 50 years will witness the slow disappearance of Germanic culture in Chicago and the transformation of Germans into something more like German Americans. So, Sebastian, let's pick up the story. Let's go back to 1870, maybe, and what's going on in Europe, namely Central Europe, where all of these Germanic people came from.
So in 1870, the Franco-Prussian War erupts. And this is when, well, like, and it's between France and Germany. There had been a considerable amount of animosity since the Napoleonic Wars, because Napoleon conquered what would later becomes Germany. And that had, in the early 19th century, had galvanized the earliest forms of German nationalism. And then when the Franco-Prussian War finally, it seems, erupts, it's this unifying moment where all of Germandom, it seems, throws their enthusiasm behind the Prussian effort to defeat the French.
And Prussia at this time is one probably the largest part of a number of various German speaking or culturally German principalities. The other big ones are Bavaria. You have the Hanseatic cities, which are free cities, so like Bremen and Hamburg, and then some other odds and ends, right?
Yeah, basically. And Prussia is the strongest in terms of military might. I mean, of course, the Bavarians will disagree with that, but
who cares about that?
Yeah, and so once this once the Franco-Prussian War breaks out, German Chicago comes out in a really enthusiastic favor for it. There is talk about how this was this unifying element where you have all these people from the various parts of Germany who come together in the German taverns and saloons and just basically embrace each other and sort of cheer the Prussian War effort on. And it takes a lot of really interesting turns in the German community in Chicago. So, and this was more by accident than by design. The publisher of the Illinois Staatszeitung, the biggest German American newspaper out of the Midwest at the time, Anton Caspar Hesing, he is traveling Germany at the time that the war breaks out, and then immediately switches gears and just starts agitating, basically. He writes travel letters back to Chicago that get published in the Staatszeitung, detailing what's going on the ground. And then Hesing has the Staatszeitung collect funds, basically remittances, and if you would call those today, from the German American Chicago to be sent to Prussian war widows and invalid soldiers who got wounded in the war. They also sponsor a flag to be planted in Paris, basically. And Hesing at some point, he at some point has an audience with the Prussian high command and to present this flag to them. And that's one of these big moments of his life, apparently. So the German community in Chicago through this line has a very direct connection to what's going on and can really closely follow the events as they unfold. It really galvanizes the community, and once the war is won by the Prussians, or rather once France concedes that they've lost, rather, and the German Empire is then founded, there's people celebrate, like German Americans are celebrating in the streets. It's people just go nuts.
Two quick questions. Did the U.S. government have any stance on the Franco-Prussian War? And was there a French community in Chicago at the time that was like, hey, what's going on?
I don't think Chicago had much of a French community, not in a significant way. I've not read anything about that. The American government was fairly neutral. The Staatszeitung lamented here and there that the American government was supplying the French with weapons, But other than that, there was not much in terms of support for that. I mean, that's Napoleon III in his regime. So there was not like it's not like the Germans were at odds with American mainstream politics in this instance necessarily. I don't think the average American cared much about what was going on.
Okay, so the Franco-Prussian War leads to some feeling of unity amongst the various Germanic peoples of Chicago. And they basically are very supportive of the effort to unify Germany, which proves in the long run to be something of a problem. But we'll get to that soon. Let's pause, though, another great event, not necessarily for world history, but for the history of Chicago, is the Great Chicago Fire of 1871. So can you tell me a little bit about the fire and how it affected the Germanic community of Chicago?
So the Great Chicago Fire happens at the night of October 8, 1871. It starts in the barn of an immigrant Irish woman. Like, there's legends that the cow kicked over the lantern, but that's been disproven.
So do we actually know now that it did begin in her shack or
yes,
shed?
Yes, that's...
Okay, so that's not an apocryphal story. That is the truth as far as...
How exactly it started, there is various speculations. It's at this point, it's I think, impossible to, without the shadow of a doubt, really prove whether it was people who were playing cards there who like threw a cigarette into the hay, if the hay just spontaneously combusted, which wet hay does that, or whether something else, some other human element was involved. That's not really, that won't be solved because it's just been too long. And also like there's too much chaos that happened after, because the fire that started that night on October 8 burns down most of Chicago, because it was a very dry summer. And at the night of October 8, there were very high winds going. And so this fire starts, and then it just can't really be stopped. Most of the city is built from wood. Most of the sidewalks are built with wood. There is a tremendous amount of wood for construction that is piled up along the Chicago River. And all of that just goes up in flames. And the city burns more or less to the ground.
And let's not forget, there are over a half a million Chicagoans at this time. Chicago is not a small town anymore. Yeah. It is a huge city.
Chicago is at the time, actually, and this is one of these really just amazing tidbits that I've learned during my research, unrelated to the Germans. Chicago at the time is actually the busiest port of the United States, which seems strange given that it is not on an ocean. It is a Great Lakes port, and also the port of Chicago is just this little stretch of the Chicago River that is intersected by a bunch of bridges. But this little stretch of the Chicago River in 1871, just before the fire, is in fact out competing in terms of just activity and in terms of ships coming and going and cargo unload and all these things. It is the busiest port before New York City, New Orleans, and San Francisco. And that's just something I always find just absolutely fascinating. And then the fire comes, and that sort of like throws a little bit of a spanner into things. And German Chicago is mostly devastated by the fire, because it's on the north, it's right on the north side of the river. So it's smacked up in the middle of town, well, just on the north side of the loop. What really then happens in the aftermath is what is most important for the German-American community, because the aftermath of the fire then sees a rise in political tensions, where Mayor Joseph Medill, who's also the publisher of the Chicago Tribune at the time, then tries to push a city ordinance that would require rebuilding most of the city in stone instead of wood. And this the German Americans see as a threat to their properties and to their social cohesion of the German parts, or to the threat to the social cohesion of the German parts of Chicago.
Why is that?
Because most German Chicagoans owned smaller pieces of land, and building on these pieces of land in brick or stone would likely have been
prohibitively expensive
because due to the small plot sizes, these individuals were unlikely to get the mortgages necessary to facilitate building in stone. And so the thinking was that they would then be forced to if they were forced to rebuild in brick or stone, they would have to sell their lands, move out of the city, or rent an apartment instead of maintaining their small property ownership.
So what ends up happening?
So what ends up happening is that there is a lot of back and forth, political lobbying, and after all of that, the mayor and the city council eventually limit the fireproof ordinance to really just the central part of Chicago and spare most of German Chicago. And so German Chicago can rebuild in wood and does not have to be this fireproof. This is a small victory for the Germans. It's also a victory for the Illinois Staatszeitung because they, through their political clout behind this, they organized protests. They organized a lot of the lobbying from German Chicago to the mayor.
Just another quick question. They certainly had still a good deal of political clout. If they were still voting as a bloc,
yep,
they should have had plenty of political power too.
They did still have a bunch of political power because it's Chicago. It's kind of machine politics are becoming more and more of a thing there.
It's okay to say.
Yeah. And
it still is.
And yeah, it still is. I mean, that's one of the reasons why they eventually are successful in that regard.
So Chicago burns down. The German-American community makes this win in that they do not have to rebuild in stone or brick. However, since the Loop area, the downtown area, has to be rebuilt in stone or brick or steel, this gives Chicago a chance to attract yet even more immigrants and workers. So after the Great Chicago Fire, there's another great wave of European immigration, correct?
Yes. And that's a new challenge for the established German Chicago, and especially for the 48ers, because the 48ers at this point have become established, literally become establishment. They kind of start to go move away a bit from representing workers because they settle into a more comfortable middle class, upper middle class life. And so their political ideals and ideas are shifting towards something that is a little more conservative. And now a new generation of German immigrants arrive, and these new arrivals that come for the jobs that rebuilding Chicago promised. And these are then largely members of a new kind of social stratum. They are industrial workers, so they are now, as we said in the last time, for the first time, people that we can actually
call Germans.
Well, call Germans, but also that we can call working class because they identify as working class in the Marxian sense. Yeah, and that's that is an important distinction because these new workers barely owned anything. They rented their dwellings instead of owning small property. They lack the kind of in-depth craftsmanship education that previous working German Americans had. They are no longer small shop owners and artisans. They don't really, they really only have their own two hands to work with. And the 48er Chicago, German Chicago leadership sees that as a problem because these new arrivals share very different interests from the established 48er generation. And as a cohesive new generation of immigrants, these new industrial workers themselves begin to politically organize because they don't find themselves much represented by the established German American community. So they begin to construct their own political infrastructure. And that creates tension. They found their own working men's newspapers, their own political clubs.
I was just going to say, so there seemed to be some sort of unified Germanic culture, and there was the Staatszeitung and the singing groups and the Turnvereine. But this new generation then it becomes, or the new wave of immigrants is no longer satisfied. So they actually create yet a second culture, Germanic culture within the bigger one.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
But then also the 1870s are, after the fire, also marked by an economic crisis. So the panic of 1873 sort of crashes the American economy. And then many of the workers who had come to Chicago looking for jobs in the rebuilding efforts face a problem that now the money is drying up because inflation is galloping, the economy is in shambles. And all of a sudden, all of these workers who come to Chicago are unemployed. And that just really exasperates the strife between old and new Chicago, because now what happens is a lot of labor unrest. So a lot of workers go on strikes, not just like the 8-hour movement has been an issue at this time since at least the late 1860s. And in the late 1860s, the Staatszeitung actually threw their weight behind the 8-hour movement. But now there's a bunch of strikes that just keep on going on throughout the 1870s. And here, the interest of the 48ers as members of the establishment and the new arrivals as industrial workers with their own self-class consciousness and self-interests clashed the hardest, because the 48ers agreed in some cases with the workers' grievances, but they really could not stand when these strikes did, you know, much that really interfered with the way the city works, especially when the strikes became violent. They would just really shout them down from the pages, basically. To, you know,
was it also that they didn't want to be associated? So the 48er Germans didn't want to be associated with the new working class revolutionary German proletariat, because they had spent so much time trying to become establishment.
Yeah,
people.
That's also a part of that. But the thing is also that they, I mean, there's a lot of different issues at play there, where on one hand they don't want to be associated with them, and then on the other there's also just the thing where these strikes these strikes get very big and very threatening. But then there's also just the thing that, because of that, that illustrates, it demonstrates to the leadership, to the 48er generation, that they have lost control of the German Chicago, because they can no longer just say, okay, we're going to talk to the leaders, or we're going to, you know, write an open letter or talk to the people in the Tonverein so that they will interfere there. They just lack that connection, and that, you know, brings them up against that. Against the new workers even more. And that really comes to the forefront in the 1877 Great Railroad Strike, when that comes to Chicago.
Is this the Pullman Strike?
No, the Pullman Strike is in 1891, I want to say. Okay. The Great Railroad Strike is the first basically countrywide labor action. Some historians say that it's sort of like the final nail in the coffin of Reconstruction, because that's when the last remnants of federal troops get removed from the South and used against the striking railroad workers, which also kind of shows where the American federal government's priorities lie. Defending the interests of railroad companies, not the interests of downtrodden freedmen in the South.
Now, in these labor unrests in Chicago, you talk about the German industrial proletariat striking and organizing. How much interaction did they have with other immigrant ethnic working proletariat groups? So were they joining forces with Slavic people and other groups, Irish perhaps, Irish immigrants? Or is the German working industrial proletariat still very much a German thing?
They are not entirely exclusively German. The Germans are, in some respects, because of their numbers, they're kind of the community leaders. And a lot of the literature and pamphlets and all of that that are printed and handed out at the time is printed in German and English. But they do also address, or they work together with people from other ethnicities. And that becomes pretty clear in the Haymarket affair, or the Haymarket massacre, or the Haymarket riot. It has several descriptors, basically. On when in 1886, during a strike at the McCormick Reaper factory in Chicago, an anarchist who to this day remains unidentified, or at least...
I think it's safe to say he will remain unidentified.
Yeah. When an anarchist throws a dynamite bomb at police that are trying to dissolve the strike action for the 8-hour day. And yeah, and so 7 policemen die directly from the bomb, a bunch more are injured, and then in the ensuing chaos, the police starts to just shoot into the crowd, and yeah, more policemen die from friendly fire, and also a bunch of civilians get killed in the whole thing. And
shootings in Chicago aren't just a recent thing, apparently.
Well, neither is police violence. And then what happens in the aftermath is that the establishment, the political establishment, uses the event to strike a blow against the socialist and anarchist movement. So dozens of suspected anarchists are indicted. 8 people are eventually tried and convicted on overblown conspiracy charges that in retrospect had little veracity to them. And 6 of these 8 people who are charged were German immigrants.
Yeah, I'm just trying to draw the link between German workers and immigrants in Chicago and anarchism. These are farther left than, so say, like traditional Marxists.
Yeah.
At the time. And can you just talk a little bit about this constellation of various types of groups, because you've got Marxists and then all the way to radical anarchists, a bunch of
groups
in between.
That's kind of
or do we need another hour for
that?
We probably need another
hour, and I would need to do more research into that. One of the issues at play here is that is Bismarck's Sozialistengesetz, so the anti-socialist law that causes a bunch of German socialists and social democrats to leave the country, and a lot of those...
So this is Otto von Bismarck, yes, who's the chancellor of a new united Germany.
Yes.
Passes an anti-socialism law, okay? Yeah. And this leads to...
And that leads to bunch of, well, this is a very, very specific term, to a large number of socialists and people who identify with this movement to emigrate to a smattering of locations. Some go to Switzerland, some go to the UK, and then some also go to the United States. And that is seen as one of these inciting moments where a lot of this anarchist movement or anarchist socialists, I mean, it's also difficult to sort of really suss out like where these people go and where this label anarchist is just something that is put upon them by the establishment press, because not necessarily all the people that are condemned by the press as anarchists are actually anarchists. They would themselves probably more identify as socialists.
Or simply workers who wanted a living wage,
right,
or some
right.
protections.
Right. Yeah. The Haymarket Affair brings up a bunch of interesting people. One of them, one of the leaders who gets indicted and hung is a guy by the name of Albert Parsons, who is a veteran of the Confederate States, but he was married to a black woman. He's originally from Texas, and he comes to Chicago after the Civil War and becomes involved in the whole Chicago workers movement. Parsons works together with the German-American worker milieu. And so that's kind of my poster child for this interaction between American, like born and bred American socialists, workers' rights people, and the German-American workers milieu.
Let's move on from the Haymarket Affair, and you mentioned Bismarck again and this anti-socialist law. As we get into the 1880s, what's happening in Germany, and how is Germany not making friends with the U.S. government?
So when Wilhelm II ascends to the...
And Wilhelm II is the emperor per se, but Bismarck is the chancellor.
Yes.
So will we call it Germany at this time a constitutional monarchy?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay.
That's pretty much what it is. I mean, it's called the German Empire, but it's still more of a constitutional monarchy. And it's kind of, and that, as a side note, that's kind of an irony of history that the 48ers really cheer this development on, because it's finally they have the United German state, but it's more of a monarchy than they originally at the time that they were trying to overthrow things were really aiming for. I mean, I have to stop myself here.
Stop yourself.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so Wilhelm II.
Wilhelm II has these imperial ambitions. That's where Germany starts to look to have colonies and become a colonial empire. And that starts actually slightly before Wilhelm II ascends. But anyway, so in between 1887 and 1889, American and German warships were engaged in what essentially amounted to a staring contest on the Samoan Islands. The Americans, the Germans, and the British were sort of all three meddling in the Samoan Islands to support candidates for the Samoan throne. And they all, like, none of them really quite understood how Samoan society worked, and it's descends into some chaos and civil war and like a small-ish scale civil war. But then the Americans and the Germans have this ongoing standoff with where the warships just basically shoot angry glances at one another, and the whole thing ends when a cyclone comes along in 1889 that sinks most of the ships involved
and destroys both sides.
Yeah, basically.
Funny.
and that's sort of really gets utilized by the American press to shore up anti-German sentiment, because the German Empire now seems suspect and seems like it's becoming a threat to American imperial interests around the world, which in reality was not really true, because the German Empire had little interest in going to actual war with the United States. And sure, here and there, like in Samoa and like in some countries in Central America, they had some small designs to maybe possibly do a little bit of colonialism there, but that never amounted to much. But nonetheless, the American press and figures in American politics take this up to make the German Empire into a bigger threat than it actually is. And along with that comes also a shoring up of anti-German sentiment against the German-American population that are already kind of under something of a general suspicion as, bomb-throwing anarchists.
Yeah, and no distinction in the popular press is made between the different generations of German Americans. There's no distinction made between like the 48ers and the new type of younger working German radical, as is often the case in the news.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then this anti-German sentiment just keeps growing and festering in the American general population. And that really comes to a boiling point when the United States enters the Great War in 1917. And that's something that for people who aren't necessarily that familiar with First World War history, the United States come late into the war, only in 1917, because the thing has been going on for a while at that point. But and when the U.S. enters the war, that really is the death knell for the existing German America.
So the U.S. enters the Great War late. Mm. But essentially, we're talking from the Samoan crisis, which ended in 1889, to the outbreak of World War I, and then the United States entering in 1917. You're saying that one can actually see a thread of increasing anti-Germanness in not only American foreign policy, but in American domestic policy as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
So this is kind of, because in the literature, it oftentimes comes across as if German America has sort of gets shut down kind of out of the blue once the United States enters the war. But that's kind of an over, that's like a gross oversimplification, because this anti-German sentiment at the time did not come out of nowhere. That's why I bring up the Simone crisis, because the Simone crisis is kind of like it's a fairly unimportant little historical tidbit. But in the greater scheme of things, if we're looking at German-American history, it's emblematic of this larger development where the German Empire suddenly seems like this big threat, combined with German-born anarchists. And goes into the whole anti-immigrant, like always sort of present, but then again rising anti-immigrant sentiment of the time that then says that, you know, Europe are basically sending the dregs of their societies over to the American shores, either just to get rid of them at best, or at worst to undermine the American project.
Yeah, that's a common trope of American politicians for a long, long time, yeah. Saying that country X is sending its degenerates to the U.S. because that country can't deal with those degenerates themselves. Good to note that, you know, that's an ongoing, unfortunate theme in American history.
Mm-hmm. From there on out, you have this rising sentiment against the Germans that are, like other immigrant communities, regarded with suspicion because of their, well, foreign habits. They're using a language that most Americans don't understand, both in speaking and in writing.
Yeah, one way to anger a red-blooded American is to speak a non-English language. Mm-hmm. Watch them get really angry, as if there's only one language on the planet.
Mm-hmm. and that's all in spite of the German Americans up to a certain point, at least, having been these almost model immigrants, because they assimilate fairly well. They, for the most part, have a large contingent of people who are in the upper middle class, and they
value education and hard work.
Right. And they introduce a number of, you know, social staples, so to speak. For example, and this is especially the 48ers, because they are so involved in politics. So for example, the reason that some people will see that as another reason to hate the Germans, but the reason that gym class is a thing, that's due to the 48ers.
Hey, for all of you who loved or hated gym class, thank the German immigrants from 1848.
Yes, but then on the other hand, the reason that playgrounds are a thing is also going back to the 48ers. So you went.
Why is that?
That's one of because the people who brought the concept of playgrounds to the United States were German 48ers.
Oh, and also kindergarten, of course.
Yeah, in kindergarten.
That's
and
the
then,
obvious one.
And then in
gym class and playgrounds. So
in Chicago, this is very Chicago specific. The 48ers also organize the Altenheim, an old people's home, where retired German Americans can go and live and be cared for.
So the retirement home as well.
This I'm not entirely.
Oh, come on, claim it.
I'm a historian.
Claim it for the 48ers.
I have to try to be at least somewhat specific?
No,
here,
you don't. But no, you
no
don't.
I don't.
So if you're in a retirement home listening to this, thank the Germans.
Yeah. But only if it's a good retirement home. If not, then it was not us. And of course, you know, beer, right? Brewing. Sure, the Brits had ales, but come on. and all of that then comes tumbling down when the U.S. enters World War One.
Let's talk about this just a little bit mm-hmm. more deeply. How does the anti-Germanness manifest itself in the day-to-day life of a German person in Chicago? Because maybe in some big ways, eventually we see the closing of the German language newspapers and things. But there are still enough Germans in Chicago that you know, it's not like their homes are getting burned down by angry mobs of non-Germans. Or were they? I don't know anything about this.
They do face some discrimination in everyday life, so they try to minimize their individual Germanness a little more to evade these backlashes. Because of these public backlash, German institutions also purge German terms from their names. So the Tonverein, the Tonvereine, rename themselves to be more American sounding, for example. The German Americans at large, really, in order to evade, in order to not be suspected of being unpatriotic or of or being un-American, they really just individually and collectively downplay their Germanness stronger than they did before. Not that they necessarily did much of that before. And as you said, like the real death blow is then to the newspapers. So the German newspapers were by law required to provide an English translation of all articles that they would publish the following day to the post office, a day before publication, and they could not talk about anything related to the war. And if you've ever worked in translation or had to pay for a translation, translations are costly. And it's difficult to provide a translation of such a large volume in such a short time. And that really broke the neck of many German-American newspapers. So many German-American newspapers just quit their operations after that. And with that, a lot of the German cultural, larger German cultural sphere, or at least German-speaking cultural sphere, that had existed in Chicago, but also in New York and other places, St. Louis, basically comes to an end. But this is kind of like an important caveat, that this, it's not just the anti-German sentiment that ends German America. It's also cultural assimilation, because the children of the immigrants essentially end up preferring the American ways over the German ways, because German literary clubs fold due to a lack of interested members, since the second and third generation German Americans essentially preferred going to the movies instead of attending discussion groups in stuffy salons discussing the works of Schiller,
Goethe.
Yeah. And so you have the second generation who are just like, yeah, they don't want to have much to do with this highfalutin, you know, German cultural sphere as much, and they just really embrace being American and embrace the novelties of American society more than they embrace the traditions of their German ancestry. And that, in combination with anti-German sentiment and all the stuff that happens in the wake of World War I, then puts largely an end to German America, or to the kind of German America that existed in the 19th century up to that point.
Yeah, and so we're not going to get into World War II, but certainly by World War II and the end of World War II, even any remaining vestiges of any sort of subculture were totally, or had totally disappeared.
Largely, yes. There were still German interest groups and like German historical societies and like people who had an interest in keeping at least some low level of German-Americanness alive. I mean, what I personally find more interesting is what happens after World War II, is because after World
and
War
II... And let's actually, I'm happy you brought that up. So we've discussed the decline and fall, as it were, of German culture in Chicago. And then let's go to the post-World War II period and talk about maybe a little bit of a renaissance of German-American culture and German-American interest in Chicago.
Yeah, and that's kind of a part of the whole story that as of today, I guess, is not terribly well explored, because it's not that happy of a story. So after World War II, there is another distinct cohort of people from Germany that immigrate to the United States. And that cohort is, well, it's interesting because it's kind of problematic because a lot of these people who immigrate at that time are more or less unreconstructed, well, people with Nazi sympathies, not necessarily completely card-carrying, full-on, but still they are very much inflected by the Nazi regime. Well, and after the war, the country is devastated, and a lot of people emigrate to the United States, which seems counterintuitive because the United States were the enemy, but it's things are more complicated than that, because a lot of the people who come to the United States and also to Chicago after the war are people from the quote-unquote lost eastern provinces of Germany. So after the war, Germany has to cede substantial territories in the east of the country to Poland. So Eastern Prussia, Silesia, and Pomerania. So Eastern Prussia becomes Kaliningrad, ceded to the Soviet Union, and Silesia and Pomerania are ceded to Poland. And the Germans who lived there are essentially pushed out of their ancestral homeland. And that creates a problem, because where do these people go? So a lot of these people then end up in West Germany, and they're not necessarily terribly welcome there. Just because, you know, like West Germany has its own problems to deal with after the war, and suddenly there's all these refugees who've been pushed out of their homelands, and a contingent of these people end up immigrating to the U.S. Another contingent that is something that I find deeply fascinating, a smaller contingent of people still are German prisoners of war who were sent to the U.S. and who spent time in the U.S. as prisoners of war, but liked their experience there so much that after the war they came back as immigrants, which is just wild. And this cohort, it's not as large as any of the 19th century cohorts. It's kind of a footnote to the whole German-American experience, but this cohort is still large enough to organize some representation among themselves, because they by and large do not get along with the established German Americans, because they're a different breed of people, a different breed of Germans. And so they organize in their own social clubs and organizations, and in that they and in those organizations they then really, at least for some time, show their true colors, where they invite a lot of like Holocaust deniers, revisionist historians, old second and third tier Nazis who are still around to give presentations and lectures. The organization that comes out of Chicago grows out of
years are we talking, by the way?
It's like in the late, like it starts in the mid to late 50s, 1950s.
So we're still talking 70 years ago.
Yeah.
This cohort.
Yeah. And it's really interesting because this, like one of the larger organizations basically forms out of a letter writing campaign to American movie and TV producers, where these German immigrants complained about the portrayal of the German World War II armies in American war movies, where they're basically shaking their fists and saying, how dare you besmirch the honor of the German soldier? And like, well, the German soldier did like a bunch of really terrible things in the war, but we're not really... Yeah, it's not really something these people want to be talking about. Yeah, and then like there's like other really just deeply weird Stilblüten anecdotes that come out of this whole affair. There is like the president of this organization in the 1980s writes protest, like a series of protest letters, and organizes a letter writing campaign to the American Congress, protesting the construction of the Holocaust Museum in DC, decrying the Holocaust Museum as an anti-German propaganda, basically. And basically, and over time, this cohort dies out. Their organizations sort of really are fizzling out over time. And these days, there's not really much left of them. But that's really the last hurrah. But not even a hurrah. It's kind of pathetic and not terribly celebratory. It's not a celebratory story of plucky immigrants who come to the U.S. and find a life for themselves. It's more of a story of people who are just left behind from the Nazi regime and never really cope with what happened at the time and then just come to the U.S. because they are attracted to the United States, among other things, because they are staunch anti-communists, especially the people from the former Eastern provinces, because they blame, of course, the communists for the loss of their territory, the loss of their ancestral homelands. And that's why they end up being welcomed with open arms in the United States in the 1950s, because they're, oh, yeah, great, let's bring them in. They're anti-communists, right? Who cares what they did before?
Yeah, well, that reveals the stories this last cohort you're speaking of, mm-hmm. reveals a lot of the paradoxes and contradictions of American foreign policy
right.
and global politics right. during the war and post-war. Suddenly, people who were far-right Nazis, we could tolerate because they hated communism mm-hmm. more than anything else. So, well, I guess that's all right. What an interesting way. I didn't realize we were going to end this podcast episode with a discussion of the strange, as you call them, deeply weird post-World War II generation of immigrants, which has complicated my picture of German immigrants mm-hmm. in Chicago even more. But I think one thing I've learned in this two-episode series about German Chicago is quite how diverse it is,
mm-hmm.
just as the German people were diverse back then and are diverse today. German Chicago is also diverse, and we've applied some tags to them, the Dreisiger, the 48ers, the ones that came after the Franco-Prussian War, the ones that came after World War II. But I guess if you look at the full picture here, German Chicago is quite diverse, mm-hmm. although ethnically and culturally German. And it's quite a fascinating history. Sebastian, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge about German Chicago with us. It was really fun learning about the diversity of German immigrants in Chicago.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Danke schön.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.